This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Aaron Levy. It's an honor to have you here, and especially on the occasion of having such distinguished speakers tonight. I know it's such a rainy evening. The weather is unpleasant, so thank you for making time tonight to come for this program. For those of you who are new to Slot, we are a volunteer network, and for over 19 years, we've been in this space as a small and agile nonprofit organization, a volunteer network working collaboratively across communities and across institutions in Philadelphia and beyond. Our mission is to advocate for the power of the arts to drive cultural change. In our programs, we try to facilitate dialogue about urgent social and cultural issues. We hope that you'll come back. We hope that you'll take advantage of our website, slot.org, where there's over 1,000 hours of recordings, free educational resources from past programs over the last two decades. And above all, that you'll come back. Tonight's program is also presented with the Penn School of Social Policy and Practice Social Justice Initiative. This is a joint venture with Slot, and that builds from the premise and the bold claim that the arts are an absolutely indispensable method and means of imagining democracy and making justice. The projects, kind of like tonight's, aim to harness the power of university and community collaborations and elevate stories and histories of the struggle for justice here in Philadelphia and beyond. There's a website, philajustice.org, that you can visit where you can learn more about what we've done. So the exhibition that surrounds you, you've probably had ample time to engage these extraordinary photographs and projects. But the exhibition is called Kim Kardashian is Dead and Other Stories. And it features the work of the artist and advocate Indrani Pal Chaudhuri, who's to your far left, and her many collaborators. And the project explores the cultural politics of celebrity, its complicities and compromises, but also its potential and its promises. In particular, we've been really interested in thinking with Indrani about the effects of the transformation of persons into images, the processes of commodification and even self-commodification that celebrity entails. We hope that this exhibition, but also tonight's event, will really be helpful in unpacking, again, these contradictions and these potentials. I want to bring it back to tonight's program and our distinguished guest, Samantha Fuentes, who will help us explore how the quest for fame motivates mass shooters. Samantha Fuentes, who's in the middle, was amongst the injured in the Parkland tragedy. Her body and her life were changed forever. She has bullet shrapnel permanently embedded in her legs and behind her right eye, and she currently manages symptoms of PTSD. She lost revered friends and faculty members, yet despite these tragic events, today Samantha is resolved and committed to a poignant mission, which is that of preventing gun violence. Samantha is a survivor not only of gun violence, but also of racism, of bullying, of parental alcoholism, of domestic abuse, and of attempted suicide. She works closely with Angel Faces, an organization that serves girls who have endured all types of trauma. Her life experiences have tasked her to champion the importance of human rights and equality, to uplift the voices of the silenced, and to encourage bystanders to participate in change whenever they witness injustice. I'd like to, before turning it over, just briefly thank Ceasefire PA, the Center for Experimental Ethnography, the Penn Injury Center, the Department of English and the School of Policy and Practice, and finally Penn Communications for really just helping us spread the word about tonight. Although it's an intimate kind of gathering, they all kind of came together to kind of celebrate Sam being here and this program. The exhibit was organized by Eduardo Cadava, G.K. Reed, and myself, with support from the Andy Warhol Foundation and the University of Pennsylvania. And then finally, we were really fortunate to receive a contribution from Telke Ganesan and the Kiba Kids Foundation to make the exhibition possible. So as for the format for tonight's program, our guests are going to speak for about an hour. Following that, Nina Lee is going to perform a song that was inspired by the Parkland shooting. And then after that, we'll open to kind of a conversation with all of you. So thanks again for being here.
So David Bowie's Valentine's Day, the last single released in his lifetime, This was created in 2013, and I directed it in harmony with him, of course, and he had been working on this song for a little while. But it's really very interesting that this was called Valentine's Day, and the subject lines up in such a remarkable way with the Parkland shooting 5 years later, which was on Valentine's Day as well. So I really wanted to look at some of the themes that go into this video, which was really, you know, looking into the mind of a shooter, and at the same time look at the consequences of our mediatization of issues like this, because I think the relationship that artists have and the media has to these really important issues is a very complex one. So on the one hand, a video like that is aiming to get people to think deeply about what that young person is going through who is responsible for the shooting. And on the other hand, David himself was very concerned about not glamorizing the shootings. And so when we created this video, he wanted to avoid signs of the actual shooting that he was depicting in the lyrics. And yet there is this strange synergy between what he's speaking about and the events that unfolded 5 years later. So I wanted to bring it over to Samantha, who really knows much more than anyone would want to know about mass shootings. And then we'll open it up to a conversation about some of the complexities that these shootings and the artists' interpretations and the media interpretations have.
Hi there. Hi, everyone. So yeah, my name is Samantha Fuentes. I'm 19 years old. I'm a survivor from the Parkland shooting. I was injured and lost some of my favorite friends and loved ones. But I wanted to start off with a piece today that I wrote that kind of encapsulates some of the subjects that we're going to be talking about, this idea of ignorance and polarization and the way that they kind of intermingle with each other. This is called Power Off. Turn off the TV screen, disconnect from the internet, and avoid the headlines. The world will feel safer once you're blind. It's easier to feel secure when you're not on the front line. When it's not your life at risk, it's easy to dismiss this national crisis when you don't live it. Just because this plague doesn't roam your school hallways, workplace, or the streets of your neighborhood, you'll say it'll never happen to me. But it could. But since your life has been protected thus far as it should, you'll live out the rest of your days like the kids in coffins wish they could. Everything a person was or ever could be erased in an instant, yet to the masses this issue seems so distant. Even though the death count is staggering and so consistent, the efforts to reverse gun violence are nothing near persistent, because the death count is just that, a number, not someone's friend, sister, teacher, or mother, just another statistic to get buried along with the others whose names and stories will be forgotten just as quickly as their lives were stolen. People are dead, justice is not served, and families are broken. When will you decide to speak up? Now, or when your last words are spoken? Because indifference is more dangerous than any gun. It puts you and everyone in danger. To remain silent is the equivalent of siding with the oppressor. The value of a human life is growing lesser and lesser, and even though we might deny it, these numbers are like you and I, with passion, goals, hobbies, and dislikes. Much like you, they believe their life was a right. Much like you, they never thought they would be forced to survive and fight, because it always starts with, it'll never be me. But if you're doing nothing to maintain the safety of his others, there is no guarantee, because public safety has a direct correlation with personal safety. America, you have forgotten that lately. You've lost touch with humanity, switched your priorities. It seems like dollar signs and profits are more important than unity. Our government leaders are focused on everything other than the people. It's like money is God and our government is the steeple. And when will we realize the true power lies in the hands of the people? That our leaders and our citizens are exactly equal, and the only thing that sets us apart is the labels. The discussion is overdue. No one's at the table, yet there's millions of us perfectly healthy and stable, and these senseless killings are no fable. Thus, we must not live in fantasy. We must plant the seed so that every single person has the opportunity to live in peace, and that's true equality. So when I initially was injured in a mass shooting, my story never was private. My address, my likeness, what happened to me became everyone else's story, and they ate that up and they gobbled it whole. And when they ate that, that feeling, that sickness that they felt sat in their stomach for maybe two or three news cycles, and then that was the end of it. And that's at least what we thought was going to happen when we decided between my peers and our community members and families that we wanted to make a difference, because this wasn't something that was just our story now. This was the story of America. This wasn't just the mass shooting that affected Parkland. This was on a degree and on a scale that we could not have understood at first. When I was injured, I lived in a bubble. I believed that what happened to me couldn't happen to anyone else the way that it did. I thought that I was special. And I had no idea the scale of violence and insanity that this country is faced on an everyday basis, whether that be in our inner cities or the people who are taking their own lives, or between police brutality, between mass shootings. There are so many different forms of this problem and so little ways that we create awareness and try to create preventative action against these senseless tragedies. But instead, we find it to be comfortable to only discuss when the extreme happens, when there's nothing but a pause in the room, because everyone remembers where they were February 14th, 2018. And so do I. And that's a reality that I harbor with me every single day, and that I show and I expose to people, because it is so often that the humanity in those numbers, the truth behind those faces, the stories behind those headlines are too often lost, and if not, not even reported in the first place. And so that's why I've dedicated my life, my time, my energy, my mental health, my physical health, to exposing that layer of humanity, that part that we need in this conversation when we talk about gun violence, because it isn't just a gun issue, it's a people issue. And it affects everyone in every community. And as I met other survivors from other parts in the country, and I learned more about myself, but I probably learned so much more about trauma and about survivor leadership, and the importance of having a network of people who can rely on each other and proceed in changing the world as we see it. And that's why I do what I do. That's why I'm here before you today, and I really appreciate all of you for showing up.
Thank you for sharing some of your experience, and you know, wanted to really ask you a little bit more about your thoughts in terms of, first of all, you've been traveling the country since this happened and sharing your views, and let us know a little bit more about, you know, what is your objective with that, and how does these you know, you have this physical aspects of the shooting, but how has it changed you in terms of your purpose in life?
Wow. Well, I suppose a few things happened, right? My heart shrank, and then it got bigger. I was initially very hopeless and weak and fragile and, to put it lightly, pitiful. And I learned through extreme pain and through suffering that there is strength in suffering. There is strength in trauma, and that the trauma that you have is a gift. And it took me a really long time for me to realize that, because it is probably the worst wrapped gift in the world. And you don't realize it until you have the ability to share that with other people and the impact that leaves on other people. So I learned really just more about humanity and how pain is so relative, and how some of the biggest, you know, social justice movements in American history has been led by just incredible storytellers who have experience unlike anyone else, and a perspective that represents an idea that needs to be changed in some way. And so I feel like stories in many ways are just examples, are just evidence of the things that we need to change, the things that we need to move forward on. And so I learned the ability of having empathy and being able to share that with people and grow as a person. But not only that, but just like learn more about the subject at whole. at large, because there was so much that I didn't understand about gun violence. There was so much that I couldn't wrap my head around because of how little gun violence is as a priority in this country, and how often it's only talked about in an extreme circumstance, when in fact it's something that happens every single day and countlessly every single day in this country. And what I mean by that is, like, I learned that gun violence doesn't, you know, it doesn't discriminate. It has no race, it has no religion, it doesn't care if you're black or white, if you're a girl or a boy or anything in between. It just is a tool that people use, and it's often a symptom to a larger problem that isn't being addressed. Gun violence, when someone commits a terrific act like that, it's usually because there is a underlying issue that hasn't been assessed. Too many cracks that they had to fall through to resort to that. And there's no intervention, there's no prevention of these kinds of things. So how do we know why it happens? How do we know when it's gonna happen? How do we know what to do in those circumstances?
So when we look at this kind of spectacle of violence, that idea of the symbolization, using bodies, using your body, using the bodies of the people around you, I think that is, it's such a tragic but also powerful statement that's being made. And so you creating your own narrative and countering that very visual narrative story that everyone has embedded Absolutely. In their brains, I think it's a great act of heroism. But you are also becoming a symbol of gun violence in your own right, and sort of a contrary symbol. What is the cost of becoming that symbol of a movement in that way to you on a personal level?
Oh, geez, everything. I have no privacy. I'm referenced to, like, what I mean by that is, like, people can use my likeness for whatever they feel like, or people have
and they have
without my permission, and things like just being like manipulated, or like being told one thing and having something else happen. What I mean by that is, like, when you go from being a senior in high school who's working a 30-hour work week at a diner, who's going to community college and has no concept of life or how people actually are, and you put that person who has just been shot in front of a camera, I tell you that the results are not good. And that was kind of one of the one of my big realizations, big like slap in the face, is that, like, people don't necessarily want your story. They want your presence. They want what you have to offer. They want the benefit they get from having you. And rather than the message that you're trying to relay, or the impact that you're trying to give to other people. And especially in the beginning, when you are freshly traumatized from an event like that, you don't really even understand, like, what your message is initially. And you don't even understand if, like, that is what you want, like, in a week or 2 weeks or even a month from then. So to be, like, just manipulated and like that, in that position, and so many people, especially, because the thing is like, when it comes to how the media works, they don't cover the story 6 weeks after it happens. No, they show up at the school and they harass students on campus, and they come to your house and they knock on your door and they send you endless messages on Facebook. It's like, it becomes like everything that you thought could have been private and a secret no longer becomes that. And I had to create a barrier between people and keep people at arm's length, because I realized that when you are vulnerable and you are fragile, people will take advantage of that. And so it kind of makes the conversation almost impossible to have, because you're having the conversations with people who have almost no sense or grasp of the situation because of how fresh it is. And as important as it is, as important as it is to have survivors on the front lines of conversations, especially when it comes to gun violence, it's also important to respect their, like, growing and their healing process and how much they can give when they have the ability to give. And that is probably the worst problem when it comes to, like, reporting on gun violence. You never get the real scope, the real feeling or the authentic actual idea that this person who's being taken up is trying to express to you. You get what the person who is giving it to you wants, if that makes sense. And it was only until a lot of us from our own community organized individually and created a movement that was represented by us and was made by us, did we have the ability to have a message that was coherent and clear, and it wasn't being like made up or slandered or misconstrued with other people's opinions. And that's power, is taking back your narrative and taking back your story and telling people, no, this is what I think and this is why I think it. People will have more of an inclination to want to listen to what you have to say. And I had to learn that the hard way. And there was a lot of things that I had to sacrifice. You know, I don't have a normal life anymore. I don't do normal things. I feel like that's with like every job, right? You make sacrifices for everything that you love. And this is just happens to be one of those things that are tangled up in all of it.
When you look at the larger issue of gun violence, because that is something that you've been addressing as well, and certainly I think that when we look at this kind of shooting as a symptom of a larger problem, what kind of message do you want to share about that?
One thing that I like to say a lot is that the Parkland story is not the story of America, and that the mass shooting and the experiences that I have, experienced, like just because those are my experiences, that's not everyone else's experiences. And so because I've experienced this mass shooting, that means that it's very individualistic to me. And so when you travel the rest of the country and you see the impacts of gun violence on different communities and different people, you see that the impacts generally are the same, but the way that it happens and the way it's carried out is different. And so what I learned by that is that, like, gun violence, much like most injustices, sits on a spectrum. And that every form of gun violence has a very specific way or angle in which you approach. So obviously, you're not going to approach the preventive action of fixing mass shootings with the same actions that you would prevent, gun-based suicides. So I learned that for every section or sector, there's different things that you can do for each. I guess the analogy would be this, like if the house is on fire and only one of the houses is on fire, you don't spray the whole neighborhood down. You would only spray down one of the houses. So the idea is that you want to combat a very specific issue with specific solutions that would help that. And so I learned some of the principles that I was learning in the beginning of what I thought would fix gun violence as a whole was only gonna fix school safety. It was only going to fix mass shootings. It was only going to prevent one kid breaking into one school and committing one act. And that just isn't sustainable, and it's not effective. And however, the problem is when it comes to the conversation of gun violence, we only have the conversation about one kind, for the most part. And it's too often that we don't have representation of what actual gun violence looks like on an everyday basis. And we get glued and over almost obsessed with the most extreme because that's the thing that is being pushed to the front line, and that is what they want you to see, because the media and everyone else has an understanding that anything that is a spectacle will earn views and will expand your audience demographic. And often and too often, that is usually what people are after. And that's why it's so important to have the people at the front line of this conversation of gun violence prevention are survivors, people who understand that line of work. And I'm not just talking about, obviously, people who have been shot. I'm talking about first responders. I'm talking about people in the force. I'm talking about former perpetrators of gun violence, people who have shot other people. You know, this is very critical information to have, and our government is effectively putting no money towards researching gun-related injuries or any of that thing. So if we have to privatize and figure out a way, then that's going to be the way to go, is coming to the source of where it happens and using that as an advantageous way to prevent it in the future. I mean, I've learned so much about mass shootings by being in a mass shooting, and that's just the truth. I mean, there's so many things that I think of now when I look back on the situation. I go, well, if A, B, and C, and D were to happen differently, then the outcomes would have been different. But that's the problem. Why does an 18-year-old girl have to get shot and learn that lesson? And then why is that lesson not being applied in everyday studies and everyday courses of preventative security task teams and all that stuff? So that was what I learned, was that like none of what I experienced was you know, like the same for everyone else. And then I'm always learning more about this ever-changing, you know, injustice, and it's something that will always change as people change. And it's one of those things where if you're not actively listening and actively a part of the conversation, then nothing will change. Also, Eric needs to talk because he's been really quiet.
Well, Eric would be wonderful to get your...
Yeah, I want to commence by a little background story of mine. The amazing thing is we've had 288 school shootings in this country since 2009. France has had two. Britain's had two. Germany's had one. The next 10 industrialized nations in the world have had a total of 5 in the last 10 years. So I concur with what you're saying. This is not America's story, but it is an American problem. And the thing that touches my heart so much about Samantha is when I brought her to Detroit, she rolls in. We had a talk with Ceasefire Detroit with some real go-getters, survivors, people who had been incarcerated, people who had met their own parents when they were incarcerated, people who grew up like I did in Flint, Michigan. And I see David Hogg on TV, and I see them. And these kids, these, for the most part, upper-middle-class white kids in a very affluent area in Fort Lauderdale, are framing this debate outside of the poor me victimization school shooting. They know 8 kids below 16 today shot them, got shot by a gun. 32 got shot today. That happens every day. And the way things become politicized, oh, it's black on black crime, or it's this. The fact that she has such deep empathy to see this. We had conversations today about what goes on in a war zone. We've had conversations about what goes on. The empathy that these kids have for disproportionately kids of color and working class kids across the country, the fact that these rich white kids, quote unquote, get it, touches my heart. And there's such a lesson to be learned here. What she said about the survivors being on the front line, you saw the talk we did on human trafficking with 2 survivors, both African Americans, one trafficked from age 12 to age 35, one from age 15 to age 40, 35 years of traffic, 6,000 rapes plus in their day, 6 to 10 tricks a day, 6 days a week, sent like circuits around the whole world. And she can see the intimate ties between domestic violence, you see? So on the one hand, we gotta put out the house that's on fire, but we need to realize the nuanced, intimate relationships between things like race and class and what I would consider poor government. This is primitive. They talk about my research on voodoo and African people is primitive. We're walking through, excuse my language, fucking metal detectors to go to elementary school. That's primitive, that's savage. So the survivors have to be empowered on the one hand, but we have to have a real national conversation. Who are we? Who are we as Philadelphians? Who are we as Americans? Who are we as human beings? Where are we going? Where are we going? Where are we going as a country? Where are we going as a society? Where are we going as a government? Where are we going with our own inner peace? And what should we do about it? We're going to hear a lot about different solutions, and I love how she keeps it focused on solutions. But the biggest cosmic question left out of that is, why hasn't it been done already? And it hasn't been done already because we fundamentally disagree on 2 issues, culture and economics. Same thing driving the 40 million slaves in the world, the same thing driving more than 2 million people incarcerated more than any place in the world, is the same thing driving the fact that 8 kids under 16 are going to die today by gun violence. It blows my mind that Sirius talks about things like climate change and school shootings, that 18 and 19-year-old kids, as bright as they are, get it better than our politicians at all levels. The March for Our Lives that your peers put together is one of the most cogent, concise blueprints for how to get out of this morass and this madness. the one thing we can't lose sight of when we talk about fame. And it's funny how things work. We hear so much about mental illness. We hear our president talking about mental illness. We hear everyone talking about mental illness. Most statistics, and there's the validity and reliability on some of these statistics, are probability. And Johnny, I know you want to talk about this, are that 95% of mass shooters, not just school shooters, but mass shooters, more than four people shot, do not have a diagnosis of mental illness. Guess what? 60% of them are narcissistic, megalomaniacs, grandiosity.
Well, that's, you know, those are not diagnosable mental illnesses, which is what I think is interesting.
Narcissistic is not, it's yes, for the most part, you're correct, yes.
But I think what's really important is that we tend to point fingers and say it's a mental illness
issue,
or it's something that, you know, we can demonize people in one way or another.
That's right.
And in fact, people who have mental illnesses are more likely to be the victims of violence,
gun violence,
than to be the perpetrators.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we need to
look. Because most forms of gun violence are committed upon themselves.
That's
60%
right.
of 60% of gun violence that happens in this country is suicide.
That's right.
And only 1.6% represents mass shootings.
And then
Less.
The second is domestic violence.
Yep.
Yeah.
And but here's what's interesting. Kids and folks in Germany are chasing fame. Folks in Europe are chasing fame. We have 393 million registered guns in this country. The next highest country in the world is India with 71 million. They're a country of 1.2 billion people. So I know that fame drives this and that it gets lost in the thing, but
well,
and I just I don't want them to
talk about that just for a moment.
Yes, okay.
Because I think it is an important issue. Because if we say, okay, it's not mental illness
yes.
that is the cause.
Mostly, yeah.
Then what is the cause? And if you know, we don't want to focus on the perpetrators because we do really care about the narratives of the people who've been through this experience. But in order to stop a problem, we do need to have an understanding
Absolutely.
Of how to do that. So if it's not mental illness, then this idea of fame causing a lot of, you know, this expression, I think is important. Because
it's super important.
When you look at the statistics, the number of actual mass shootings has not really increased over the last 50 years. What has increased is the body count. For the most part, it used to be that a mass shooting was considered two people,
mm-hmm.
and now it's, you know, 20, 30, 40.
Yeah, I think it depends on each source that you go to, because, like, if there's different, definitely Google this later, but there's so many different websites on the internet that actually have documentations of each mass shooting that's happened since, I think, 2002, depending on the source. And each one defines mass shootings as something different.
That's right.
So some websites will declare that a mass shooting has to be like 8 or more people, and some people will say 5 or more, some will say 15.
Four or more.
And so now the definition of mass shooting, and I think that's the interesting part is just to add in a point. The more that you argue the technicalities or the definition of what something means, the further from the issue that you get.
Yeah.
So the more that time that you try to figure out what a mass shooting is or an assault style rifle is, the further you're getting from the issue.
Mm.
If you are trying to label something and then confuse other people of what it is, then you're not talking about the issue.
Good.
You're talking about a detail of the issue.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to say that because I feel like that gets people further and further from the issue because then people will say, well, this wasn't a mass shooting, or this was, or this was this. And it's like, well, it doesn't matter because it still happened.
Yeah.
And I feel like that, at the end of the day, is not the bottom line.
It's really interesting, though, when you're talking about the statistics and that increase in how many people are impacted in each of these events. One of the correlations that we found looking at all the research is that the media coverage also is
impacts.
Based on this absolute body count basis.
And those seeking the media coverage are getting the media coverage.
Yeah,
there's
absolutely.
A positive correlation with that, which is really important.
Yeah. And the mass shooters have spreadsheets that they often tally how many people they need to shoot in order to get the media coverage.
Especially the Columbine. There's a real serious following, and your perpetrator too has his own following online, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not going to name them. So this grandiosity and this desire. So where does it come from? It's not just a chase for fame. These are upper middle class white kids. Robert Putnam wrote a book, Bowling Alone, about how Americans, you know, going back to Tocqueville and democracy in America, compared to the rest of the world, our quote-unquote exceptionalism, we're always joining associations, whether it be a shooting club or a bowling league or a fraternity or a sorority or the Rotary Club or whatever, we're always doing that. But we know that we're not joining associations anymore. We know that there's a certain toxic masculinity dare I say, that runs throughout the world in misogyny, but it takes on a nuanced difference in America. And a lot of these school shooters are not getting the girl. They're disgruntled. They're lonely, right? So, and then they try to outdo each other.
And there is this correlation between domestic violence.
Absolutely.
And that kind of of gun violence as
And
well.
She talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, which is
she talked about it. But this idea, the interesting thing about the name of this talk, the mass shootings and the quest for fame, is fame is not brought up very much. It's very sparse in the literature, all the literature. Of course, it helps when we have a CDC that looks at this, like human trafficking, for what they are, which are public. This is a public health crisis. And it can't even be framed that way. And our tax dollars can't even go for research that way, the way the government is set up, which is a problem as a whole. But what is missing, conspicuously absent from this debate, is this grandiosity. Now, it's interesting because in the 70s, when Christopher Lash writes his Culture of Narcissism, and then people like Robert Bella comes with his Habits of the Heart, and Arziger starts looking at this idea that there's this shift, right? David Harvey, postmodernity, time and space have been compressed. We're moving from this exterior, external related society into this individual me culture. We talk a lot about the me culture. It's true.
The desire for fame?
Well, I know this. I know that, and it's, I don't know where the reliability and validity is, but the best one I've seen, and I forget it was a co-edited author, looked at a news media analysis through the New York Times. And shooters who carry out school shootings, this is just looking at school shootings alone, were mentioned about 72% in the New York Times. These were people who were not chasing fame. Those who we know from manifestos, from their online postings, from the suicide notes, from whatever's left before, were being mentioned at about 99%, for example. So there is no doubt there is a correlation, not just between how many are killed and how bloody, if it bleeds, it leads, how much coverage it gets, but we know those who are actually seeking the fame are getting the fame, at least from the amount of mentions they're getting in the New York Times. There's other ones that have been done out of Europe. It's amazing how people outside of the U.S. give us more research on ourselves sometimes. That there's no doubt that's there. And before you had a conversation with me about this, and I brought in, I didn't have any idea. I knew that there is some narcissism going on here, right? But I had no clue just how strong that was. So we know that about 60% of all mass shooters, not just school shooters, are chasing fame. We know that 5 to 10%, depending on who you ask, have a diagnosable mental illness. Yet we hear not a drop about the quest for fame. And all we hear is more on mental illness. Now, some folks are mentally disturbed. There is mental illness that drives people to violence. But it's not on the level that this narcissism is. And it's not just the narcissism, the typology of it. These tend to be, and I'll tell you from my research what I see that's interesting, that's missing, and I'm glad you brought up suicides and you brought up domestic violence, and you brought up quote-unquote urban inner city violence, because I could talk about terrorism and I could talk about counterterrorism, right? And we can talk about mass shootings writ large with violence in a way. And it's interesting, when I look at groups like Al-Shabaab or even Boko Haram and some of the stuff that I've done in West Africa, there's still a quest for fame, not just social media, but even within your own in-group or in your own community, there is this desire to be pedestaled and to be somewhere else. How do I move from the realm of the powerless to the powerful? I'm never going to be famous. I'm never going to be noticed. She's never going to love me. He killed 4, I'm going to kill 10, I'm going to show them, I'm going to show 12. And it's amazing to me that there's not more research done on this and that this is not discussed at all.
So because the patterns are so apparent.
Right, right.
It's apparent. It's obvious.
So I think to me, what's really interesting is that the statistics show that like 60% of young people actually would rather be a celebrity than have a career.
Yes.
there's some.
That's the number one. The number two is 15% want to be a doctor or nurse. This is out of Britain, a sample of 1,020 16-year-olds, and 60% of them want to be famous. That is their thing. And of the 60% that want to be famous, 30% of them think that they will be famous through a reality TV show.
Or dating someone famous.
Or that was the second, if you date somebody famous.
Right. But so ultimately, well, if that is such a powerful trend, and for people who feel excluded from having a voice, ultimately it is a question of power and a question of how people can express themselves. And when guns are put in the equation, when access is available to everyone, it creates this sort of shortcut of a way for people to get heard who feel like they can't be heard in another way.
Absolutely.
And when we talk about, which is interesting because when we're talking about statistics, when it comes, like, in even in the conversation of, like, what people choose to end their lives with, and this might be a little dark. When it comes to the choices, like inhalants, like drugs, or like actually throwing yourself a building or shooting yourself, guns are usually the first option.
That's right.
Because they're the quickest and most efficient, and they're the easiest to get your hands on. And like when it comes to like the way that you see people killing themselves, like in our country, it's guns are the number one killer. So when we talk about accessibility, we don't just talk about accessibility in the sense of, oh, like, how am I going to get this weapon to kill other people, but how accessible guns are to people who are mentally inept to have one. And let me just paint this picture for you for a second. So as you know, I was injured in a mass shooting about a year and some change ago, and I am incredibly traumatized. I have really bad PTSD, depression, anxiety. It's irreversible at this point, but I can go and buy a gun. I can go buy a gun, and nothing is going to stop me from buying this gun. There's no background check. There's nothing that's going to say, oh, are you okay? Are you feeling all right? Well, the guy selling me the gun's not going to give a fuck about how I'm feeling that day. So the point is that the accessibility is so important, especially when it comes to the conversation of mental illness, because they're hand in hand.
Yes.
And especially when we talk about, you know, when we're talking about gun violence, we also have to talk about gun culture and the rhetoric that surrounds, you know, the sales of guns, the way that we promote guns in this country.
Which go up every time something like what happened to Parkland happens.
Absolutely. Every single time there's a mass shooting, sales in guns go up. It's crazy. And the way that we advertise guns, we advertise guns like they're cheeseburgers. We pose with them with beautiful, vivacious women, stand next to these AK-47s and pose to them and sell them to you like burgers. The way that we commercialize these weapons, the way that we have almost, the way that we capitalize on these weapons opposed to, you know, seeing them what they are and what their purpose is. They've become flashy toys at this point. Because, you know, the idea of, you know, the Second Amendment in this discussion of that being important, it's absolutely important. But is it as important as other people's lives?
Yeah.
So because that's the problem here, is that just because something is accessible to you and you're a law-abiding citizen and you don't have previous mental health problems and you're not someone who is going to go and kill someone, doesn't mean other people won't. And we don't have a system that prevents that from happening. In fact, we have a system that enables people and encourages people to purchase guns because it is the easiest, quickest, convenient option. And that is often not part of the conversation, because when we talk about like the, you know, the want for fame and recognition, and a lot of times the reason for that is because it's a symptom of a big problem. There's something that hasn't been addressed. And when it comes to like my shooting in particular, this was an act of revenge. This was something that was, you know, premeditated. It had a video manifesto, had several Instagram posts, things that this was something that was in the making for a long time.
And by the way, 3/4 of those are, that's the mental illness thing. If you're predetermining something and planning it out for 2 or 3 months ahead of time,
yep,
which has happened in 80% of the cases, that's not indicative of mental illness.
Right. Yeah. No, that's indicative of a habit. Do you know how many days it takes to get a habit?
Yeah.
I think it's 21.
Depends on what you're doing.
That's the thing. And we often don't think about those things,
right,
as habits. We often don't think of thoughts and
right,
urges and tics and things as a habit. If this is something that is routinely going through someone's mind and there isn't a system that prevents it or tries to assess the situation before it occurs, then the system's not working. And then the guns that were made to protect us and others become the weapon of oppression. And that's the problem here, is that we are trying to protect people with guns, but people are also trying to kill people with guns. And you can't fight fire with fire. And that's just a very simple way of looking at it. I mean, obviously there is like extensive other issues when it comes to this conversation, but it really comes up, the bottom line is the priority of safety and what that means to people and what that looks like to people, because safety does not look like the same thing to everybody.
Sam, there are 5 million guns today in America, we know this, at the minimum, that are unsafe. When parents are asked, are your guns in a safe area, 72% of them are unaware that their kids know where a locked gun is in the house. That's 5 million on a daily basis. I know we talked about statistics, but I want to expand the scope a little bit based on what Indrani said. We have 3.9 million deaths per 100,000 in this country due to gun violence. Kids, you're not a kid anymore, but kids under the age of 18, it's the second cause of violence next to car crashes in this country. 3.9 per 100,000 sounds like a lot. Guess what it is in Venezuela? It's 52. Guess what it is in El Salvador? It's 53 in Venezuela. It's 52 in El Salvador. It's 48 in the British Virgin Islands. Guess where all those guns are fucking coming from? We talk about the border, and the truth is if we weren't doing all this dope in this country, that border wouldn't be an issue. And guess how they maintain their power with that dope? With guns. And guess where guns come from? Here, across the border the other way. So that's what I mean about the expanding the scale and scope of our conversation. And we have to talk about school shootings. This is a uniquely American effed up problem, as we've alluded to.
Well, and if we're going to expand it to talking about nuclear proliferation as well, you know,
right.
as the ultimate manifestation of imbalances of power and ways in which we are really setting ourselves up for major problems if we don't address.
And the U.S. is not the only ones doing it. Russia is peddling them. There's other Western nations. Italy is a huge manufacturer. Germany, United States probably per capita is the worst, but they're not the only ones. There's a lot of money in guns. And when you use up, and you got to constantly be evolving. I mean, the new talk with nuclear proliferation is $1 trillion to update our nuclear warhead. I mean, we go backwards with a lot of things, with race and with class and things. I mean, Detroit's still, for all the talk where I'm from, is still more segregated than it was in 1960. Same thing with the nuclear things. We were talking about it at lunch, Dr. Levy and all of us, about it was such a big deal. Even in the 80s, even under Reagan and even under Bush, we had these nuclear proliferation. It's out the window. So this idea of collective, what people in peace and conflict call positive peace, not the absence of violence, but real positive peace, is missing around the world.
Well, and if we come back to David Bowie's video, which I think was really interesting because when we discuss this subject of creating a video about a mass shooting, his motivation was that he saw in himself as a young man all of that angst and all of that desire for violence, which so many people share. And he was recognizing that if he didn't have this outlet of music, this way of expressing himself that was able to change minds and put him on that global stage, he might have taken a more violent route. And so that was something that, you know, he discussed privately. I don't know if he ever intended it to be shared in such an open way, but it was what motivated him on one of the very last statements that he shared with the world, is this idea that communication is so important, that sharing your story and being heard and having power through ways that are not destructive, but rather can contribute to the conversation. So I'm so thrilled to be able to open up that conversation and to, you know, bring in questions from the audience. And
I think that's great. That's a fascinating story. That, I mean, for just Bowie to be so forward thinking to see that, and to really, so what he was honestly saying is that if I didn't find this fame and this success, there's a damn good chance I could be doing the same thing. And that's brutal honesty. And I think a lot of us lack that. I mean, we talk about how kids go to school worrying about shooting all the time, but how many kids have thought about going to school, or not even going to school, but just shooting another human being?
Yeah. And what does it mean to a society where it's not just the demon, the person you can't understand, but what if it is something that everyone has an urge sometimes?
Yeah. I think, like, we were talking about this earlier, but, like, I know that this might be hard to imagine, but everyone is capable of killing another person. And that's like a brutal and scary fact to live with, and it holds such gravity, but it also means the very opposite too, that we're all capable of love and kindness and compassion. And it's those very things, those urges, the things that you get in the back of your mind, that's synonymous with every human experience. But I think it's the human part of us, the humanity that we hold, that keeps us from doing that. And it's humanity in others that keeps us from doing that. And so I feel that when you see that these acts are being carried out, it's usually the lack of humanity.
Yes.
And the lack of retaining that and understanding the value of life. Because there is little validity in life if there is no humanity, if there is no kindness, if there is no compassion. Because someone cares. Someone, anyone out there does. But the problem is if there's no proof of that, and if there's nothing that says otherwise, and if there's nothing that proves to me at the bottom of my heart that I'm worth being a human being, then I'm not going to act that way. No one would. And so it was like, how can we create a future, a world that we live in where people feel enough to just be a person, just to be able to vocalize how they feel, communicate, and be open about these urges, these feelings that they have, without being stigmatized, without feeling like they're actually a monster. Because I'll share this with you. I've thought about killing people before, but that was after I was almost killed. And I think about it all the time, about the revenge that I could take or the steps that it would have to happen in order for me to do that. But the truth is, the thing that keeps me from always revolving around that nasty, nasty thought that I get is the fact that I have people who care, that I have humanity in my life, that I have things that make me feel human and make me feel cared for and validated as a person who's experiencing things along with you. And that is something that is often not rectified in a conversation when we talk about gun violence, is we don't talk about the value of a life and like what that means to us. What does safety look like? What does saving a life look like? Because sometimes saving a life isn't necessarily taking a gun from someone else. Sometimes it's way before that. It's a conversation you should have had 6 months ago. But there's no priority in that. The system does not care. And we need a system that does. And there's only one way to do that. You gotta replace that. You gotta take the things, those people that you don't think represent you and our government, and be those people. And if you're not happy with the results and the current climate of how everything is, be the change that you want to see in the world. Gandhi said that. Mm-hmm. And try to just connect with people on a human level and be that connection that people so often crave. Because there are times where I think about it, and I was like, there's times where that could have been me, right? Like, there's times where any of you could have been you. But there was something in your life that anchored you down. There was something in your life that said, no, that is another human being.
It's ironic that shooting happened on Valentine's Day, the day that we celebrate love, and that Bowie also called his song and discussed this idea of Valentine's Day being a time when violent thoughts arise or this potential for violence.
Yeah.
And they do. Domestic violence is up on Valentine's Day. The amount of murders and shootings are up on Valentine's Day.
And that's the thing. There's
holidays
really nothing, there's almost nothing ironic about it. It's actually very fitting. And something so, so fitting and almost so foreseeable that could have been stopped. And with that being said, if we know that we're all human and we all work in patterns and we all have our rituals and we all wake up at a certain time and go to bed at a certain time, like, we have at least a basic understanding of how to stop this, because we have a basic understanding of how we work as people. But we've lost touch with that, and that's kind of the major flaw in this conversation, is people want to blame a piece of metal, or they want to blame a piece of paper that made that metal exist in the first place. It's not about that.
Yeah, can we open it up to some questions? And then we have a performance by a wonderful artist who was inspired by the Parkland shooting to create her own piece. But I think if we want to open it up to questions first.
Questions and comments.
Yeah, just absolutely. Talk it up, man.
I'm really grateful for the way Samantha framed so many different kinds of trauma that make up the nature of our life in America as the problem. And what I keep thinking about and hearing when we talk about intimacy or community and family is that we have so many things that have made intimacy less and less possible, even not even just prevalent, but possible. And fame seems like one model that is built around a lot of people at a great distance with a kind of admiration or fear of you. Followers, it's a similar kind of thing. There's a distance that won't be crossed. And I would love to hear, maybe, Samantha, the nature of the conversations that you have had with survivors of many different kinds of trauma, and what kinds of intimacy you have tapped into, and whether you feel there are social models or behaviors that could replace our kind of atomized internet means of being with others, which I think also short circuits possibility for intimacy.
I find that the reason that intimacy is so hard to achieve is because it's almost like it's wrong to be authentic. It's wrong to be vulnerable. Like, there's something inherently wrong with being the most authentic version of yourself. Because when it comes to like what is popular and what is trendy and what is, you know, publicized and what is 100% of the time most marketable is changing yourself and being a different version of you so that you can succumb and get molded into whatever version that they want you to be. And that sits on a really large scale. So like, you know, children come to learn that, adults come to learn that in many different ways, but that also keeps us from being our authentic selves with the people that we love and cherish most. And that's because a lot of times we teach people to do as we say and not as we do. And it's just generations and generations of people trying to create a better life for people, even though a better life is not available, if that makes sense. And what I mean by that is love and compassion and understanding is all accessible to people, but it's only accessible when you are the version of yourself that you are all the time, and you are the most authentic person of yourself. So you can only have understanding and receive love if you're the vessel ready to do so. And so we often live in a society where different versions and different faces of one person all the time. And we often don't connect on a real human level, a level in which we have a genuine understanding of each other because we're so often spending too much time being someone else. Yeah. And I know that that might sound so simple and so general, but it is literally the dynamics of how our media works, how our celebrities work, how everything that does successful in this world works. It's about what is the best version of it, not what is the realest version. Mm-hmm. And so it really comes down to that. When I've met new people and I've connected with people, it is not because they were incredible or flashy or rich. It was because they were real. And I've come to learn people and become friends and become really close with other survivors because when you've had something really traumatic happen to you, you don't have time to create another face. You don't have time to create another layer or another mirage for other people to see because you're too consumed in healing and growing. And when you meet with other survivors, you just have this rawness with one another. It's this rawness you don't get from anywhere else. It's something that if you could only have an ounce of, it would change your life forever. Mm. And that's what I've learned, is that when you strip away everything, when you take the things from people that they loved most and you squish it, humanity comes out of them in the purest of forms. And it's in the ugliest of places that you find the most beautiful things. And that I could only understand more about myself when I learned to understand other people. Mm. And that's what I've learned with meeting other survivors and other, you know, victims of gun violence, is that there is no time for politeness or any of this, you know, like, let me pretend I'm cool. It's really just about being yourself.
Raw and authentic.
Yeah.
And it's not just, so she was telling us at lunch today that Professor Smith, that not only was the bond so much stronger among the Parkland community, but everywhere she goes, and whether you see somebody who's, and the funny thing is we all think our violence is our own game sometimes, and we think, oh, you got to grow up in the inner city to experience violence, or you got to be a product of it. But when we really get honest and authentic, what she's talking about, there's just so much violence in so many of our lives, and the thing we can never lose sight of is the people perpetuating that violence on us also came from violence. That's what the power of forgiveness is. And I work with addicts and alcoholics all the time, and I have to tell them, you're not forgiven for your dad who raped you. You're forgiven for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you dig deeper and they do the moral inventory in the story and they talk about their pops or whoever it was that beat them or touched them in an inappropriate way, 99 out of 100 times, that person had that done to them too. And it doesn't make it okay, but it's this great vulnerability, man. And I can, as a professor, be vulnerable with my students. I'll lose my job. I got to mandatorily report. So even the whole idea of mental health and counseling and psychological services, I don't want to get political with it, but it's broken, man. It's broken. And she taught me this. This is an amazing girl right here, man. This She's an amazing girl. Other questions? And Adrani, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that polarized opposition between power and vulnerability, I think, is the core of this question, because when you have a gun, you don't need to be vulnerable anymore. You're actually saying, I'm the opposite.
Yeah,
I'm powerful.
Yeah,
I can control you. I can make you love me, or I can make you at least behave the way I want you to. And of course, that's the death of intimacy is in that power dynamic that you're taking on when you decide that gun is more important than that real genuine interaction with someone, which may not go according to your plan, but is certainly going to be a much more of a two-way real conversation.
I've been listening to you talk, and I'm wondering about the family, and I'm wondering, what do you think should be stressed or taught in the home starting at a really early age so we don't have these kinds of concerns today? And then what do you tell your children when they go to school every day? So, you know, what happens in the home? How do we change lives? And then you don't want your child to go to school and be fearful, but what do you say?
Well, my mom often says that the worst thing that she ever did was send me to school. As you might imagine, she had no control of that. And there's nothing she could have said to me that day or any day after or before that would have made me feel any safer. Unfortunately, there's nothing that you can tell your children, like words, are not going to make your child feel safe. You can create a realm, a world, a home that inhibits safety, and it shows them what it looks like and what respect to another human being might be, and you can create a realm that emphasizes the importance of that. But once they walk outside of those doors or wherever they're walking into, that idea is always going to change because of how impressionable they are and how they're constantly changing in their development. There are no two words, three words, four words that you could ever tell a child that will make them feel safe except for, I love you, have a good day. Mm. And that's just the reality. There's a structural problem with their society that unfortunately has made me come to the conclusion that there is nothing I could tell anyone that would make them feel safer about going to this place or that place, because there is really no guarantee. So I think maybe that safety here in this conversation really isn't the priority, but like love and compassion and them delivering that upon other people might be priority, because that in itself is preventative action.
Yeah.
Having a home and having children who amplify your message of tolerance and understanding and respect and compassion is preventative action and whenever they go. Because your child, is a direct representation of you in all of its weird little glories. And that's the only thing you can do. Because even if you create a world in your own home that has the characteristics of safety and love and compassion, the world will not have those things. However, they will have that person you put out into the world, and that's a gift. And so there isn't anything that I could say to a child that make them safe, because like this thing that is going on in their head only makes sense. The only thing that you can do, like I said, which is another form of preventative action, is just create a space that's safe for them to actually verbalize how they're feeling, for them to feel accepted. You know, tolerance is really important in a household. And just having something, and seeing that and encouraging them to do the same for others. Because everything is a domino effect. You know, some of the best love that I've ever experienced wasn't necessarily from my home. It was from some of the kids that I met in my school, or some of the teachers that I had, or some of the counselors or coaches that I had. Yeah. And it was because someone in their home told their child to love a little more and care a little bit more. And they did that. And then in turn, myself, some impressionable kid, had the ability to do the same thing. And so some people's homes don't encourage that. They don't make that a priority. And it shows, because they're a product of their environment. And it's so often that people who come from homes like that, homes where, you know, love is not a priority, where safety is not a priority, where food and water and just general necessities is not a priority, that their character will develop into that. And that's why it's important to understand that the people that you meet are just a reflection of what they've been taught. And the only preventative action you can have is just to be a more loving and kind person. Like, as like cheesy and as like half-assed as that may sound, it's the only thing I can say, because it's the only thing that I can think of when it comes to like what could have potentially stopped my school shooting. Yeah. It was love.
Thank you so much, Samantha, for your amazing words and perspective, and Eric Montgomery and all of our wonderful audience here. Thank you for joining us and for these wonderful questions. And we're going to be hanging around. We'd love to chat some more and discuss these ideas further. And thank you so much, Aaron and Eduardo, for bringing everyone together.